This is the Create in the Future podcast, and I'm your host, Jordan Kraus. This episode is sponsored by KMS Realty and Nova Home Loans, your local real estate and home loan experts. To learn more, visit kms-rentals.com and volpeteam.novahomeloans.com. I'm joined today by our middle school music teacher, Miss Alexandra Anderson. We're here to talk about how you make music personal. Welcome. How are we doing?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, fabulous. Before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself, your teacher journey. Those of you, those listening who haven't, you know, had you as a teacher, as you'll elaborate on, I'm sure you've had some experience in our upper elementary, mostly our middle school in your time here, but tell us about your teacher journey, you know, pre-TCDS and now at your time here.
Yeah, so I grew up in a very educationally oriented family. I actually have two cousins that have their degree in elementary education, and my grandmother was an elementary educator and principal for her whole career. And academics were very important in our household, but we're also a very musical household. My parents even met in high school choir. They didn't like each other in high school. It wasn't until later that they got together, but they knew each other when they were in choir together. And both my sisters were very musical. One of them is a chemistry professor, but she sang in choir. The other is an elementary music teacher, and she plays oboe. So it was kind of just natural that I fell into music along the way. I picked up violin in fifth grade, started piano in seventh grade, joined choir in high school, started playing the cymbals in the marching band in college, and then picked up guitar. And it kind of just, you know, went on from there. I had a lot of really amazing teachers that showed me a passion for music, including my very first violin teacher, Mr. Gil Strapp, all the way through Dr. Griggs, Dr. Mian, and Dr. Baldridge in college. I mean, just a lot of amazing teachers. But I didn't originally plan on going into music education. I wanted to be a music therapist when I graduated high school. So music therapy is still a pretty new field.
Yeah, I'm assuming what is that?
You know Gabrielle Giffords, the congresswoman.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that was one of the places that I first learned about music therapy. After she was shot, one of the things that she received along with her speech therapy to help her regain cognitive functions was music therapy. Hmm. It's something that I don't know as much about it as I wish I did, but they've found it to be beneficial for autism, for PTSD, for depression, and even dementia. Like, they find that people can access memories through music that otherwise are lost. Hmm. But it's still a really growing field. There's not a lot of positions, so you kind of have to have a master's to be able to get a job. So my plan was to get my bachelor's in music education, do some bridge coursework, and then get my degree in music therapy. But my second year in college, I started doing field work, and I fell in love with the classroom. I can't imagine leaving again. It's just where I was meant to be. So it was really kind of a strange journey. It was not the intent. But I taught my first year in Montana. I taught fifth grade through 12th grade orchestra and beginning guitar in a super tiny town. I met my husband while I was in college, and he got restationed to Tucson, and then we got married and I moved down here, which is when I found Tucson Country Day School. And I started as the fifth grade assistant teacher in January of 22. I taught STEM at Camp Adventure the following summer. Mm-hmm. And then November of last school year, I got moved up to the middle school music position. And then last summer, with Miss Kanai's assistance, we brought music back to Camp Adventure.
Amazing. Gosh, January 2022, it seems like longer.
Right?
That you've been here. That's, you know, just a couple of half, no, 2.5 years. And you've had quite the impact in your time here, which we'll kind of unpack here a little bit. As a music teacher, I just got to ask you this question right off the bat. Like, how do you define music? Like, and is this a definition you've had your students ponder?
So hilariously, that's actually a question that I started having them agonize over right before spring break, and we came back to it today. So we utilize our shorter class periods on Wednesdays for music history, and especially connecting with our Respond and Connect standards. So we started learning about the medieval and Renaissance music, so like 600, all the way back in August. And we talk about music and, you know, culture and music of the era. They learn about a couple of composers. We listen to a whole bunch of music. They do a little bit of research on a composer that they get to pick. And then we move on to the next one. Well, we finally got to the modern era just recently. It's taken all year because I like them, you know, kind of dip their toes in various eras. And unlike, you know, political and religious beliefs that have, you know, been controversial for years between different groups, it's not until around 1900 that we start to see musical movements that cause people to fight, like straight up have arguments and screaming matches. But around the 50s and 60s, we started to head that direction. So before we talk about that, one of the things I ask students to do is define music. And a lot of times they try to say, well, it's something that sounds good, but a good definition should never be subjective. It shouldn't include opinion, only fact, things that are quantifiable. So I force them to remove opinion. And I even bring up, you know, some of you don't like country music. Some of you would rather eat glue than listen to rap. Some of you, like, if somebody turns on old 50s and 60s in the car, you're jumping out the window. It's not happening. So if we start using opinion, then we start having issues with even popular styles of music. So what they come to, what most musicians, including myself, have come to, is that it's sound organized in time. There needs to be sound, and it needs to be intentional in some way. But other than that, giving it an objective definition, there's not much else that you can put in there that doesn't become an argument of what does one person like versus another.
So music is sounds put together with, you know, what did you use? What was the term?
Intention.
Sounds together with intention. You're having students make their own music, right? Through this composition project. Tell us a little bit about how that process works and how kids are kind of discovering maybe their own definition of music through that experience.
Yeah, so part of the reason we waited until second semester to launch this project is because I want them to have some ground skills as far as creating like audible music goes, but I also want them to have experienced some different periods of musical history and kind of have some ideas about like, okay, I like how this sounds and I don't like how that sounds and this is a way of doing things. And even today, I kind of urged them to consider using some compositional techniques that challenge them. So things like John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds is wildly controversial in the music world because it's just somebody sitting at a piano for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And Cage argues that because it's intentional and there is sound happening in the room, that it is music. Everything is music.
Wait, and hold on. So there's a guy just sitting at a piano, not playing it, for 4.5 minutes, and like that's a song.
Yeah, it's an actual piece written by composer John Cage, who passed away in 1992. And your reaction is about what I usually get from kids. Last year, I even had a kid that when I performed it, they were like, that's not music. They freak out. So obviously, I don't want them to, you know, do that. I want them to actually put something on a paper so they perform their instrument. But I encourage them, you know, don't be afraid to think outside the box. So my first year teaching, I actually started creating this hyperdoc, this project, when I was teaching orchestra. So along the way, over the last 4 years, there's been a lot of tweaking. I've like recreated the project so that way there's one version suitable for orchestra, one version suitable for band, and one version suitable for choir. And it's got, you know, a lot of resources. It gives them a lot of information. It helps them review things that they've already learned, gives them a little bit of guidance for the process, and of course, a rubric so that way they know how to get an A. But even the rubric is a little bit vague on what I want from them, simply because what they should be creating is something that is at the appropriate level for them, but otherwise I don't want to affect their creative process. Like if they want to write something really traditional sounding, they should do that. But if they want to write something that's very modern, maybe a little bit unusual, they should have space to do that as well.
So what would you say is the aim of this project? What's the purpose? What would you want your students to take away from this or even remember, like 10 years down the road, for example? What's the why with this project?
Well, part of the why is that CREATE is actually one of the four major standards for arts on the national level. And so the part of the reason I originally created the project was because the academic supervisors in the district that I was working in Montana were like, as a first year teacher, we're going to have you create a hyperdoc. It's just a slideshow or a doc that has all these resource links in it, you know, sort of a one-stop shop for a larger project. And I was like, okay, and I need something in my curriculum to fit a standard that I haven't touched on yet because I'm supposed to do all four over the year. Create. Sure, let's do that. And it was actually kind of intimidating for me. I didn't do really any composition or improvisation in my educational experience. Like, there were little snippets here and there, but nothing that was like a larger work that I really had to connect with. And so for me, part of it is giving them that experience that they're comfortable doing something that's maybe a little vulnerable, that's new, that's not like what they've done before. So they have diversity in their experience. So maybe they'll be a little less afraid of improvising or composing than I am as an adult because, well, I did it once and maybe it turned out well and maybe it didn't, but they've done something before.
So speaking to that, this project has an end product. Students write a composition based on their personal interests, you know, what they're learning about, you know, music in different eras. So there's an end product that they perform on their own instrument, right? But there's this really interesting kind of messy process that goes into that final product. So how do you balance having students learn from and value the process versus, you know, valuing and maybe putting all their eggs in that end product and, oh, it didn't sound great, therefore it wasn't, you know, a valuable experience. So talk to us about that kind of product versus process with this project.
So even the rubric definitely emphasizes the process in a way. So they're required to have it be 24 measures. That's it. They can work by themselves or in a group of up to five people. I've never seen music that had more than five composers listed. So that seems, you know, like a pretty reasonable threshold. And it needs to start and end on the correct note for the key signature that they're writing in, which is a rule that some modern music, like modern classical music, not necessarily pop music, doesn't follow. But it was a rule in music for over 1,000 years, and it's going to help their piece sound more like they're probably expecting it to. They're supposed to use rhythms and pitch intervals that are appropriate for their difficulty level. So obviously a piece for advanced band written by an advanced band member will have trickier rhythms and maybe some harder leaps than something that a beginning band student will write. There should be dynamics and articulation so that way what's on the page can be recreated by another musician without the composer in the room, just like a piece of music that you'd buy online. But other than that, they're free to write anything that they want as long as it includes the instruments that they play in class. So like if you've got a student that plays piano outside of class, but maybe plays trumpet in class. I do actually have a student that plays both of those instruments. He can play both in the piece, but because he plays trumpet in class, he does need to play trumpet for at least part of the piece. But other than that, there's not really any rules. As long as it's clear and it's at an appropriate difficulty, whatever they write is good. So if they don't like it at the end, you know, they've learned something from that. And if they love their piece at the end, they've learned something from that too. Maybe they love it and their grandparents go, that's not music, you kids these days. Mm-hmm. And that might happen and that's okay too. So even the rubric, like you can get an A while having a piece that sounds really weird and all kinds of messed up. But like, that's okay, because a lot of pieces that are actually really considered great now, when they were written, were really controversial and not necessarily well-loved.
Well, and I wonder what percentage of pieces that are written actually make it to the airwaves that we actually hear, right? I would imagine that most compositions that have been written have been tossed aside or, you know, didn't make the final cut, right? But through that process, you learn.
Yeah, I mean, and even what we see on the final airwaves, that's only a fraction of the music that exists out there that composers decided was worth putting out. Mm-hmm. But a lot of composers throw away their own work because they don't think anybody's going to like it. So from the beginning of a project to anything that we actually hear, And also thinking about the amount of music that's been lost throughout history just due to poor record keeping, we only see a tiny, tiny fraction of what's really out there. And there's even some amazing pieces that we don't hear because they're just not well advertised. And as we all know, there are some pieces that are very well advertised that many of us don't necessarily like. So being well known isn't necessarily always indicative of good music anyway.
So you're saying Taylor Swift's music might not be that good?
I'm not trying to get into a fight with Miss Kanai. That is not the goal.
That we were playing Taylor Swift music, by the way, this morning at the gate all morning, and that was hard. Yeah, I'm just going to leave that out there. I probably just made some enemies right now. But hey, maybe I'll learn to be a Swiftie. In your music class, you teach skills, of course. You also provide resources. It's like, why are both necessary in your music classroom?
So for me, the big why on that is the fact that you're always going to have some music teachers that you think the absolute world of and some that you wonder why they teach, just like with any like category of teaching, because there's always that whole like, oh, those who can't do teach. But we also know a lot of people who can do really well who cannot teach what they know to save their life. I mean, so helping students learn that they don't have to only know what their teacher knows is really important to me. So like my husband learns a lot on YouTube University and I've seen the impact that that has had on his capabilities. So I don't see any reason why students shouldn't have the same ability. The one issue that they of course, you know, run into with being younger and maybe less experienced is they don't always know which resources are good information and which ones are just absolute trash. So I provide some vetted resources for them of like, hey, these are websites or YouTube channels that put out quality lessons on information that you need to know or information you might want to know, or even ones that have instant feedback opportunities for practice. So like Rhythm Randomizer, they can plug in rhythms that they need to practice and it'll generate random rhythms for them endlessly to practice. And it even has a feedback option where they can play the rhythm so they can learn what they're not understanding. And that kind of instantaneous feedback and practice at home is not something that really existed when like we were kids. And so they have this massive advantage of all of these online resources for free. They basically have like this free online tutor. And so just like any music teacher, there's tons of things that I don't know. I have deficits. I'm a violinist by trade. It's been years since I picked up any of the instruments in the band room. And it's not like I just, you know, have free access to go grab one at the music store to brush up on my skills so I can teach them this particular thing. So I tell them sometimes, you know, I don't know the question that you're asking, but you know what? There's a ton of amazing professional flautists who are getting paid to play flute every single day, that play their instrument all the time on YouTube, putting out free lessons on how to do dynamics, which is what you're struggling with. So how about you go find a video and send it to me and I'll let you know if it seems legit? Or how about I find a video and send it to you? Because I'm not going to be able to demonstrate that for you right here without an instrument. So there's always those basic learning block skills that they need, like here's how to understand this rhythm and here's how to start to understand how to read pitch and here's some of the basic technique points of your instrument, just like learning a new language. But there's a lot of higher level skills that honestly, there's more qualified professionals online to teach them than I am. So by giving them that freedom of like, hey, go find your resources, use a little, you know, common sense. If they seem like they're kind of full of it, maybe don't pay so much attention to them, but go learn things for yourself. You don't have to wait for me to teach you.
Nice. The band room. You've done a lot in the year, you know, plus that you've been in that space. Talk about some of the upgrades, renovations, how you've improved that space for your students.
Oh man. Yeah, there's been a lot going on down there. So those of you that haven't been to the band room since like beginning of last year, you should come check it out. One of the things that I'm very conscious of is that the rooms that are next to mine are not necessarily music rooms. And so they may not appreciate having 16 to 20 beginning instrumentalists blasting away at 8:30 in the morning. So one of the things that we invested in was some sound paneling to try to help reduce the noise. So part of that is creating soft things in the environment. Hard things just cause the sound waves to reverberate. And as they bounce around and collect, it kind of becomes overwhelming. So soft things will help absorb sound waves, and things with angles will help break sound waves. So some of our panels are softer, but flatter. Others of them have like little pyramid shapes on them. So we've done that to kind of actually help reduce the decibel level that's experienced in the room, which is also better for students' ears. Like, they need to protect their hearing, especially if they want to go on in music. If they lose their hearing abilities, that becomes less of a reality for them.
Randomly, isn't, I think I came across some stat a while ago that the number one driver of like early hearing loss, I don't say hearing loss, but you know, what impacts the hearing is like marching band, like teenagers, kids like in marching band, you know, where you're in like a big room, it's just loud all the time, right?
Yeah. So that's actually something that is one of the resources that I put on the Google Classroom for all my kids is like, hey, if you're especially noticing that the band room just feels loud to you, you should invest in some hearing protection. Because if you have more than, especially in an enclosed space with no sound paneling or dampening of any kind, if you have more than about 10 band instruments, because different instruments are different volumes naturally. String instruments are our quietest, woodwinds are a little bit louder, but brass and percussion especially actually have a really high decibel level and can damage hearing pretty easily if you have more than about 10 of them in an enclosed space for a period of time. So any students that are in a larger band ensemble or in marching band should definitely consider, you know, there's even low-cost earbuds that also have hearing protection built in that you can get those. I invested in some ear protection in college because I was in the percussion section for the marching band, and it definitely would have had some damage. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, they can get loud. Right.
Very loud.
So what else have you done in that room? Some chairs, right? That you,
yes.
Revamped that, very important tool.
So it seems silly. We're talking about chairs. Like, right. It's just a chair. You can like buy a chair for like $10 at Walmart, I think.
Yeah, a folding chair or something. Like,
yeah.
So why put time and energy into this venture?
So we all know that some chairs are more comfortable than other chairs, but it's not just about having students be comfortable. But the chairs in our room are actually pretty expensive. They're about $60 to $70 each, and some models will even go up to $80. And so it seems a little bit frivolous at first to spend so much on a chair. And we're really fortunate. All of the chairs that we have were provided by donors or donors choose. So we had one family that brought in a whole bunch of chairs when we put out the donors choose. And then a whole bunch of other people donated for us to get the rest. But the difference is that some chairs actually help build posture, where other chairs encourage poor posture. And as we all know, back health is really important for like life. If you have back problems, it affects a lot of things. But for musicians, almost every single musician can tell you music begins with breath. Even for string players, if you don't breathe together, you don't play together. And if your hip alignment is off, your shoulder alignment is off, and then how you play your instrument is off. And so not only does it affect their ability to play their instrument correctly, if they can't get a good breath, and it can affect how long of a phrase they're able to hold, especially for brass players that rely upon air speed to be able to change pitch, it can affect their ability to play the correct notes. And some students, especially if they're trying really hard to fight against a chair that's encouraging them to sit in a poor posture way, it can cause pain trying to sit correctly. So rather than having students fighting the equipment to try to, you know, be comfortable and do what they do and want to do well, it made more sense to ask our community to help out and get us equipment that was going to help students do what they do well. And since we've changed the chairs, I've noticed that all of the ensembles actually have better tone production. A lot of our brass players, their pitch accuracy has improved. And some students even told me, like even our beginning band students that only were in the folding chairs for a couple of months before we got the new ones. One kid sat down in the new chair for the first time and went, "Oh my gosh, my back doesn't hurt." And I was like, "Oh my Lord, I didn't even realize this kid was in pain all these months playing their instruments." So I think that's really Like, it's more important than it seems like it is to have kids be able to do well pain-free. It's worth it.
How would you sell the music program to fifth graders? Fifth graders are getting ready for middle school. Why? Why should they join beginning band? Why should anyone here, you know, as when they're coming to the middle school, join your program?
Music is community for life. I was never in athletics in school, at least not past like middle school. And I know a lot of people find their community there, but as you get into, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, for some people that maybe don't take as good care of their bodies, even as early as 30s and 40s, certain sports become inaccessible. Like, your body just can't do it anymore. But a really great example of the fact that music is forever, Itzhak Perlman. Arguably the greatest violinist alive today. I don't know how old he is. He is in a wheelchair and he still plays his violin so well. He puts 20 and 30 year olds who should be more agile than him on a fingerboard to absolute shame. And he still enjoys playing with other people. And he's not just like some stuffy classical musician. He's gotten in touch with his Jewish roots and actually plays, I forget the term for it, but it's essentially like Jewish folk music jazz. It has a heavy improvisational aspect. And so he has community wherever he goes. And even though his body can't do a lot of things that he used to be able to do, he can still make music. And so I've even found that, you know, if I want to be part of a community, join community choir or the church choir or the community band. Like, if I'm having trouble finding people to hang out with, like, just go join a music ensemble. All of my friends in college were in orchestra or in the marching band. And a lot of them actually weren't music majors, but they enjoyed doing music in high school. And when they joined the groups in college, suddenly they found that they had a lot of friends. Whereas maybe before they were kind of struggling to make friends in college, because a lot of your other college students are really just there for the class and they don't really talk to anybody in the class. They're there for the lecture and then they go home. So a music program is a great way to build community and to have an activity that if you enjoy it, you can do forever. And on top of it, it's actually really great for your brain. Music is the only thing that scientists have found that activates both halves of the brain at the same time. It activates the language center. It activates the emotion center. It requires critical thinking. Like, you have to be able to recognize what's essentially a foreign language on the page and turn it into something beautiful at the exact same time as 4 to 100 other people sitting around you like that.
And what's so sad is you see music programs being cut in schools. It's not a tested subject. It's not something that you can, you know, distill down to a standardized test. And that just really bums me out, because you're absolutely right. Music is an incredible therapy. It's an incredible teacher. It's an incredible heart and brain developer. The math that goes into reading music and, you know, being a part of that group, it's huge. And what I so love about music is by nature, it's kind of project-based. You know, project-based learning, big part of our academic framework here. You learn by doing. You learn and develop and acquire some skills through the process of creating something. Well, music is creating something. It's creating something that doesn't exist without your participation. And so by its very nature, music and our band program, it's a wonderful project-based learning. There's collaboration. You know, there's that final performance, that product that I'm going to put out to an audience, to my parents, grandparents, that they care about, right? So it's just so wonderful to hear how you have helped grow our program here and help driving it forward. I'm going to throw out something to you, this idea. What if we had a quartet or a group like perform at the gate in the morning when kids are coming through? We have our little boombox there. We're playing some music. I mentioned we played Taylor Swift this morning. I'm still recovering from that. But how cool would it be to get like our band kids or choir like out of the front gate? What do you think?
So I've actually thought about that. The hard part is definitely the fact that at that time in the morning, the middle schoolers are so not awake. Yeah, they're not like awake 7:40. At all.
Yeah.
lot of our kids, you know, kind of stumble in right as we're about to start flagging. You can still see this like pillowcase lines on their face and you're like, oh honey. But I've actually thought about that, especially because our advanced band this year, last year, the advanced and intermediate band were essentially combined just to give a larger ensemble size. But this year we decided that it was really worth it, that their levels were different enough that they would have a more engaged experience by separating them. And because of it, our advanced band's actually only 5 kids. So we even have a quintet ready to go. Yeah. So I'm not sure that, you know, 7:45 in the morning is the right time for the middle school brain, but they actually do perform in the mornings on Fridays. The choir has been singing the national anthem most Fridays at the middle school flag ceremony. And starting this Friday, every other week is going to be one of the bands, actually. So advanced band is going to do the national anthem this week. And then choir and then intermediate band is picking up the national anthem the week after.
So 8:20, anyone listening, come to our flag ceremonies and you can get a performance. Sounds great. Yeah,
they do a really good job. They have a lot more confidence than most kids their age. It's really hard to be the only person carrying your part and to know that, especially for like the smaller bands, that if you mess up, people are going to hear it. And so for them to get up there and just like do that is amazing to me, because it terrified me when I was their age. But they do it and they work really hard to know that they're going to be okay and that the mistakes will be minimal and that if they do happen, that they can recover and move on.
Yeah, there's like this wonderful vulnerability that experience forces a child into. Like, I'm about to make a sound out of this instrument, whether it's good, maybe not, but those are wonderful emotions and kind of like healthy anxieties to grapple with, you know, early on and then overcome. And those are other, you know, really important, really skills and mindsets that being a part of a, you know, performing band provides a young child, which is great.
And actually going back to the question about, you know, why should the fifth graders join band or choir next year? That's even part of it. You know, don't think that just because you're somebody that maybe is not comfortable being up in front of people that it would be a bad experience for you. I have lots of kids in the program who before our first concert, Mrs. Anderson, I don't know how this is going to go. I have stage fright. I told them, it's okay. You're not up there alone. You have this team of people who are your friends now, right? They care about you and they're going to support you and I'm going to be there and you're going to be okay. And we've actually had quite a few kids, even just in the, you know, a little over a year that I've been with the program, that it's actually helped them be less stage fright because they're afraid and then they get up there and they do it anyway. So being part of a music ensemble is a great way to grow confidence. And we have a lot of fun. For those of you that missed the last concert, we did have a dancing dinosaur during Jurassic Park. So it's not like it's all work and no play.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to have fun. Allie, you've added so much value to the music program here the last year. We're really grateful for the work that you have done here at TCDS, and super grateful for what you're building and appreciate you coming on today to give us some insight. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.